Can you hear me now?
What did you do that I did?
Pull this turn off.
You didn't tell me.
I'm sorry.
Okay, so, yes, I'm going to talk about Jeremy Bentham and utilitarianism. And Bentham is considered the founder of utilitarianism, at least in the sense that he developed some of the terminology and didn't invent the word utilitarianism itself, but certainly his ideas are utilitarian. And the reason I'm talking about this is because I'm writing a book about Bentham, and so I'm sharing with you what I've learned. There's a tremendous amount of information about Bentham. There's a tremendous amount of things that he published. Not even all of them have been published to this day. So when we get to the Q&A, you may ask me a question, and I may go, gee, I wish I knew the answer to that. So there's part of Bentham that I'm learning a good deal about in writing the book that I'm writing. So that's what we're going to talk about, but I'll try to answer and even talk a little bit about some other things just to give you a kind of orientation towards his philosophy. So first of all, just some very general things about utilitarianism. It's considered to be a moral philosophy and also to some degree a political and legal philosophy. And the basic idea is captured in what Bentham himself called the principle of utility. Utility being an 18th century word, not meaning exactly what we mean by it. What Bentham meant by it roughly is the idea that the morally right act to perform is the one that will produce or would produce the most happiness for everyone affected by the action. So what you're supposed to do in applying this is, roughly speaking, figure out whenever you have choices, which one would produce the most happiness for everyone concerned. Your happiness counts, but so does everyone else's happiness, and the idea in morality is to produce the most happiness for everyone. It accepts, and Bentham accepted, what's called a hedonistic theory of value. That goes back to the ancient Greeks, for example, to Epicurus. And that idea that's contained in what I've already said could be put this way. That the only state that's good in itself, or the only state that's intrinsically valuable, to use some other terminology, that the only state like that is pleasure. The only state that's bad in itself or intrinsically bad is pain. And those are the only two things that have intrinsic value, either intrinsic goodness, which is pleasure, intrinsic badness is contained only in pain. Happiness, Bentham thought, consists in experiencing a lot of pleasure and very little or no pain. It's to have, you might say, an enjoyable existence or an enjoyable life, which he would have described as a pleasant life with very little pain, or ideally none. What the utilitarians thought was that many other things besides pleasure and pain have what we call now instrumental value, because there are many things that can produce pleasure or produce pain. So for example, money might be instrumentally valuable for some people because if they had money, they could purchase things that would give them pleasure. And many other things would be instrumentally bad because they could or would produce pain. But for example, money is not intrinsically valuable according to a utilitarian because it itself is not experiencing anything. It can cause experiences both pleasant and unpleasant. So using those basic ideas, Bentham thought especially about the design of legal institutions. He himself was trained as a lawyer and devoted most of his attention really not to morality itself or morality independent of law, but he wanted to design legal institutions so that they would be producing the most happiness, or they would encourage people to act in ways that would produce more happiness. So that's just a little overview of utilitarianism. I'll say more about it as I go on. Bentham himself, Jeremy Bentham, lived from 1748 to 1832. He lived a long life, 84 years. He founded this school, as it's called. His greatest follower, immediate follower, was John Stuart Mill, who in fact was his godson. Mill's father, James Mill, had become a follower of Bentham's and was in his circle and helped to edit his books. And when he had a son, John Stuart, Bentham became his godfather and was involved in John Stuart Mill's amazing education. You may know something about his remarkably early education in Greek and Latin. I think he learned Greek when he was 5 years old and so on. And so by, I don't know, 12 years old, he knew more than most adults did. He was part of Bentham's circle. And probably he's considered the greatest utilitarian, at least people who know the name or know that term are often familiar with Mill's book called Utilitarianism, which was published in 1861. The so-called classical school of utilitarianism kind of culminated in a third figure from the 19th century named Sidgwick, Henry Sidgwick, who taught for many years at Cambridge. Neither Bentham nor Mill taught as academics. Sidgwick, on the other hand, taught at Cambridge for many years and published a book first in 1874 called The Methods of Ethics. He went through a number of editions until his death in 1901. Sidgwick and Mill differed on some things with regard to philosophy as compared to Bentham, but they basically followed him, and in fact both of them did speak about the principle of utility and developed his ideas in thinking about morality. Bentham differed from Mill and Sidgwick in being focused especially on law, and neither Mill nor Sidgwick was that as interested anyway as Bentham was. So that's kind of an overview of the philosophy and at least of the beginnings of it. Let me say a little bit about, what I hope to do is I'll say a little bit about Bentham and his career, and then I'll talk about the book that I'm writing a book about called, sorry for this title, An Introduction to the Principles of Morals and Legislation. That's the book that Bentham wrote that I'm writing my book about. That was published in 1789, and Bentham published a second edition of it in 1823, when he was in his 70s. So let me say a little bit about Jeremy Bentham. He's an interesting, and in some ways oddball, you might even say crackpot, kind of a character. Like Mill, extremely precocious intellectually. I think his father wanted him to be a lawyer and pushed him to excel academically. In those days, more advanced people in England were interested in, or considered France to be sort of the most cultivated society in Europe, and so Bentham was sent there as a young man to learn French. So he spoke and wrote in French. In fact, a number of his manuscripts, anyway, are in French. He went to Oxford when he was 14 years old, which was young for that. I think he had somebody who sort of guarded over him or escorted him here and there because I think the older students ribbed him and kidded him and bullied him and so on. So he needed someone to protect him. He then went and was trained as a lawyer. But became interested in philosophy, I think especially through France, French influences, and worked for many years on different kinds of legal treatises. And the book that eventually became, I'll call it IPML, if you don't mind, it's the Introduction to Principles of Morals and Legislation. So he worked off and on IPML, and here's just a feature of his kind of strange way of writing. The book was finished in 1780. He was then 32 years old. And it was printed in 1780, but not published. It wasn't sold. So most of the book was actually printed. He got a snag. There was a certain issue that he got into towards the end of writing the book, and he couldn't figure out the answer. And he worked on and off for 9 more years on it. and finally published the book in 1789. And there was a little bit that was added at the beginning, a little bit that was added at the end, but most of the book had been written in 1780 and printed in 1780. It was a total dud. Hardly anybody read it. And he toiled away on various projects. One of his most famous ones, that some of you have probably heard about, if you know the French philosopher Michel Foucault, who wrote this book called, in English, Discipline and Punish, which is a history of ideas about punishment. And Bentham, about 1785, kind of looking for some way to make some money, actually, came up with an idea for a new design for a prison, which was he called the Panopticon plan of prisons. And it's rather notorious now in that it's thought to be very inhumane, but he thought, in fact, it would be an excellent new and reforming design for prisons. What it would do is encourage people to develop skills and to build up work habits. It was a big devotee of work habits and the work ethic. But the most notorious part of the scheme was that the cells would be arranged in a circle around the central observing sort of tower. And the warden or the superintendent who was in charge of it or the subordinates would be able to look into every cell for 24 hours a day, basically, to make sure that people were working and not being off or doing something that they shouldn't be doing. So the Panopticon scheme has become a kind of a byword for surveillance, for state surveillance. Bentham wanted the English government to build these prisons. He thought they would be much better than the ones that were in use, which were basically jails. They weren't really prisons in those days. People were housed in county jails rather than in state-run prisons. And Bentham thought his scheme would be much better. And it took him about 15 or 20 years before he finally got the no from the British government, which angered him immensely because he thought that aristocrats were scheming against him and didn't want to espouse or fund this reforming kind of institution. And so it was that point in his life, which I think would be in his 50s, that he became what was called a philosophical radical. And he became much more politically liberal or radical than he had been, for example, when he wrote IPML. And in the latter part of his life, he was deeply, deeply critical of the English government. He adopted a lot of really advanced political ideas like democracy, almost complete general franchise. He was prepared to let women vote, which was very advanced for that time. He is famous, probably some of you know his name, for his ideas about animal rights. And in IPML itself, in 1789, he wrote that, in a famous passage, he wrote that the French have realized that the color of a person's skin does not make any difference to their rights. And he thought that, mistakenly, I think, that Haiti was an example of enlightened treatment of race. But he said, no one yet has really addressed the further question about whether animals have rights. But if the color, he says, if the color of your skin doesn't make any difference to your rights, it shouldn't make any difference whether you have fur or not, or whether you have a tail. And so he argued that the same principles that spoke for opposition to racism and opposition to any kind of prejudice among humans would also have very significant effects in the treatment of animals. It's a delightful and very powerful passage. He was also against imperialism. And he wrote books attacking France and England for having colonies, and he wanted all the imperial nations to free their colonies, and so on and so forth. He was quite radical in a number of ways. Towards the end of his life, John Stuart Mill helped him edit his writings. He could never quite finish things himself, but he had grand schemes that never panned out. He wanted to write what he called a complete code of law. So there would be constitutional law, there would be penal law, there would be civil law, there would be international law, all guided and basically designed on utilitarian grounds. He talks about it in the introduction to IPML, that I have this grand scheme of ten codes that I'm going to write. And when he died in 1832, none of them had been published. although one of them called the Constitutional Code, please don't ask me about it, it's an 800-page book I haven't read, but it was meant to be an enormous guide to a constitution. I mean, ours is, what, about 3 pages, and Benton's was 800 pages, and counting. And it wasn't quite finished when he died. They published many of his works after he died in the 1830s and 40s, but he left an enormous number of manuscripts that were never published. They ended up at University College in London. Some of you may have visited there, and there is what's called the auto icon of Jeremy Bentham, which is his mummified body, and is in a glass case there. And they had these manuscripts, and they started, the scholars there started producing what's called the New Collected Works of Bentham in 1970, and so that's 50 years ago. They published about 60 volumes of his collected works. Some were printed in his own lifetime. Many of them are just manuscripts. And they're still going. I think it'll take them about 40 more volumes, and maybe 49 years to finish. But Beck and I were in London last summer, and I got to see some of his manuscripts because I wanted to see some of the things related to the book I'm working on. And I can understand why it's slow, because his handwriting is terrible. And he also would just cross out and work on things over and over again. So it takes a long time to edit the manuscript, and I hope they finish soon, because there's some stuff that I need for them to publish that they haven't published yet. Okay, so he was an eccentric man. You could judge that maybe by the idea that he wanted his body mummified and put in the institution of learning that he helped to found as University College. He was very intellectual and sort of a hermit. He would spend many, many hours a day reading. He had a wicked sense of humor, I think, actually. So let me just give you, So let me just read you one thing from a book about sort of the history of humans' relations to animals, where Bentham has an important role. So this is something you may not know, that before Bentham's time, moralists had insisted that animals should never be given Christian names. But in the late 18th century, which was Bentham's day, people started to give animals human names. So Bentham owned a tomcat that originally he called Sir John Langhorne. As the cat grew older and more sedate, his name was changed first to the Reverend John Langhorne, and then to the Reverend Doctor John Langhorne. That was his cat. Apparently he was so attached to animals that it created sort of moral dilemmas for him, because he actually liked cats and mice the same. And so this created a real problem about who to root for here. He has some delightful eccentricities. Also, for example, he was considered a total crackpot because he exercised. And he used this sort of jog through the city of London, which nobody did. It was just really peculiar. But it seemed to work well because he lived into his 80s and lived quite a long life for somebody in those days. Okay, so that's Jeremy Bentham. Let me now talk about IPML, the book I'm working on. And it also exhibits some of these kind of peculiarities of this man and his sort of philosophical writing. So the book was written in 1780, but not published until 1789 because he thought about certain problems for 9 years. The original idea, and you have to dig a little bit to realize this is what it was supposed to be, the original idea was it was not going to be an introduction to all of morals and legislation. That would be too drastic for him. Originally, what it was supposed to be was an introduction to a penal code, right? Meaning that attached to it there would be a list of various acts that would be crimes or offenses, to use his word. And you'd use the principle of utility to determine which acts should be criminal offenses against the law. And then also it would tell you the proper punishments for actions, as well as dealing with some other issues. There's a lot of material in the book that's devoted to philosophy, to psychology, rather than really moral philosophy. So he talks a lot about the different kinds of pleasures and pains. He talks about what he calls sensibility, that is to say, how sensitive people are to one sort of pleasure or one sort of pain. The differences in their characters and their sensibility to different psychological stimuli. And there's an extremely interesting chapter called Motives, because he was very interested in them on the grounds that motives can lead people to commit crimes, or motives can lead people to obey the law. And he was looking for the law to influence decision-making so that people would obey the law more. And he felt that you had to understand why people did things or what motives they had for acting in order to design the laws properly to influence people's behavior. So that's what it was going to be. There was going to be a penal code attached to it. You kind of like, say, the Texas Code of Criminal Law, or for any other state, that would be with the list of offenses and the list of punishments and so on. And then this introductory material about psychology and about morality to help explain how this penal code would be designed or was designed. So the penal code was not published in 1789. So you had an introduction to the penal code. That's what the book was originally supposed to be. But no penal code. By 1789, he changed his ideas some, and he said, well, you know, this introduction could be used for other things. You could use it to design other codes in the law, like the Constitution. And it would help you to think about lots of problems. So he sort of repackaged the thing that was originally introduced, this penal code, and said it's usable for other purposes. What's interesting when you look carefully at it is that all throughout the book, at the bottom of the page, in the editions that are completely accurate, all throughout the book there are references to the penal code. So it'll say at a certain point, you know, blah, 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 and it'll say, see this, you know, see penal code about this. And there is no penal code. There are other features of it as well that tell you that it really was just an introduction. So, for example, you can go online and you can look at, you know, through Google Books, you can look at old books. So if you look at the first edition, you can see that the pages in IPML are all in Roman numerals, which tells you that it was meant to be an introduction, and that when you got to the penal code, there would be Arabic numbers 1, 2, 3. So it was all set up as something to be introducing another thing that he never published. Not only did he never publish, it's never been published. The collected works of Bentham that they're publishing, it still hasn't produced the penal code. So one of the reasons why I wanted to go to the UCL last summer was to see, well, is it there at all? I mean, was he just making this up? Was there really, in software they talk about paperware? Is that the right word? it's a product that doesn't exist, but that, you know, if you buy enough of them, maybe we'll actually produce it. So I was trying to figure out whether the penal code is vaporware, whether it actually existed. And yes, it does exist. the manuscripts exist. They're over there. I think he probably would have needed to work for many years before he could have actually put it together. But the preliminary work is there in the folders that you can see there in this careful handwriting. And my daughter and I, who were doing this, I was especially interested to see whether the penal code said anything about cruelty to animals. Because as I said, there's the famous passage there that says that animals feel pleasure and pain just like human beings do. And so it's possible to violate the rights of animals. That's what he says in the book. We have that. That was published. But then there is the little note at the bottom that says, see cruelty to animals in penal code. And I thought, well, that would be interesting. And sure enough, it actually is there in the manuscripts. And it talks about how people who are cruel to animals like horses should be punished. And so he had discussed that particular thing over and over again, and never got published. And if I'm not mistaken, this was maybe 100 years ahead of his time, because I think England was the first country that ever enacted statutes making cruelty to animals a crime. I think that was about 1880 in England, maybe a little bit earlier. And Bentham in 1789 was suggesting, and in fact wrote a little penal code saying, this is what you should do for people who beat horses and other things. So it was, the penal code would have been nice if he'd ever published it. Okay, so, that's the basic plan we have. And as I say, all we have is the introduction now. It is very curious that this book is considered one of the three great works of utilitarian philosophy, in some ways the founding of the school. The other two great works are Mill's Utilitarianism from 1861 and Sindrick's book, The Methods of Ethics. But the first one is Bentham's Introduction from 1789, and I've told you a little bit about what it was intended to do. Let me now say some specific things about this, where you can sort of see how he was applying the principle of utility to the design of what I think we could call criminal law, a system of criminal law. His phrase is penal law, but I think criminal law, which is our term, is probably accurate too. So, these ideas will seem familiar to you to some extent, but then I'll get into some of the details where his thinking may surprise you. So if you're thinking that you should design the law to, among other things, set up a system of crimes and punishments for these crimes, and your whole goal is to design it so that it produces the most happiness for society, how are the basic way you're going to think about this? Well, first of all, you're going to think about certain acts that are morally wrong. And using the principle of utility, an act would be morally wrong, technically speaking, if it didn't produce the most happiness. If you had a set of alternatives and you chose an act that didn't produce the most happiness, or you might say it was suboptimal, it was less than the best you could do in terms of the consequences, that action would be wrong, according to the principle of utility. Now that seems, you know, so kind of abstract a way to talk about this, that we can probably just say, you know, just to keep things relatively simple, and in the Q&A we can talk more. But another way to describe this is to say that wrong acts produce pain, right, for somebody, right? And the right act would be the one that would produce happiness, roughly speaking. So what you're thinking about is the actions that people can do to one another, and in fact to themselves. You thought about this too, about actions that affect yourself, or self-regarding acts. These are the acts that would produce pain for some or many people. And if you're a utilitarian, what you're going to try to do is cut down on the number of those acts, either to prevent them altogether, if you can, or to reduce the number of wrong acts. And so if you figured out which acts are wrong, then there's going to be an inverse relationship between the number of those wrong acts and the amount of happiness. If you cut down on the amount of wrong acts, you're going to increase the amount of happiness in society. Right? That sort of, you can understand that. And the more wrong acts you have, the less happiness you'll have in society. Right? So you're going to use the law to try to cut down on wrong acts. How do you do that? Well, what you're going to use in the criminal law is punishment. He's thinking about punishment in a specific way. Again, he wasn't the first, but he was certainly very methodical in thinking about deterrence. And so the idea would be that punishments could cut down on crimes because, for one thing, the threat of being punished would induce people to refrain from committing crimes. So that if you say to people who are rational, and he thought that people are rational, even criminals are rational, generally, that if you say to people who are rational, if you commit this kind of act, you will suffer thus and such amount of pain. You have to calculate carefully how much. But if you make a threat like that, then many, many people will refrain from committing a crime in the first place. And that, if they refrain out of fear from that kind of punishment, then we say they're deterred. And that would be the basic mechanism. Now, what's going to happen, although Bentham sometimes had trouble admitting this, but what's going to happen, of course, is that sometimes people will do it anyway, in spite of the threat. They will commit the crime. Right? And so what you've got to do at that point, of course, is actually, after a trial, of course, and after conviction, you've got to actually impose the punishment that you threatened. So at that point, there's a different sort of situation. You're not just threatening anymore. Now you've got to actually impose the punishment on the people who have broken the law. And if you do that, it will have, presumably, if you design things properly, it will have two socially beneficial effects. First of all, it's going to have the most effect, presumably, on the person you impose it on. So that if somebody is, say, put in prison, right, that's going to make them very unhappy. Right? It's going to be a painful experience for them, as Bentham looks at it. And when they get out of prison, they will be reluctant to commit crimes again, so that their values and their expectations about what will happen to them if they commit crimes will be changed, and they will be more likely to obey the law, given that they've suffered the punishment. The other thing that this does, of course, is that it poses an example to other people, not the people who undergo the punishment, but others. And they will themselves perhaps change their behavior so that they now realize committing a crime is riskier than they had thought, and so they will refrain as well. So nowadays, theorists about the criminal law talk about specific deterrence, which means the deterrence you get from actually imposing a punishment on a specific person, and general deterrence, which means that that person serving as an example to others will reduce their tendency to commit crimes as well. So that was how Bentham thought that the criminal law could promote happiness, was through deterrence. He realized that criminal law could affect people's behavior in other ways. We can talk about that again in the Q&A. But what he was going to do was, and now I'm going to start to focus on some of the really interesting specific things he has to say. What you're going to do is use the principle of utility to determine, for example, how severe you should make punishments. Because for this kind of institution, there are going to be costs and benefits to using it. Looking at it through Bentham's hedonistic theory of value, the costs are that you're imposing pain, when you actually inflict punishment, you're imposing pain on a criminal. That's bad. That's intrinsically bad to do that. And also, there will be what I guess we could call it the general costs of administration. If you run a prison, people have to pay taxes in order to manage it and run it. And so that's an expenditure of people's money that they could spend in other ways. So that too represents a cost to society. But on the other hand, if it's working properly and people are deterred, you will get less crime, and that's a benefit to society. Less crime is more happiness. So you get benefits, but you have to get these expenditures of pain. And that's the sort of basic trade-off that Bentham has in mind. And of course, what you're going to have to do, because he wanted precision, he didn't want to use any more pain than you needed to. He wanted to be frugal, as he says, or economically pain. But you don't want to be too lenient either and make the mistake of not punishing enough where you could have prevented more crimes effectively. So you have to figure out, in any given punishment, how severe to make it. Now, the amazing thing about this is that Bentham had really no information to solve this kind of problem. There was no information in 1789 about, really even about criminal records to begin with in the flesh of England, but let alone where anyone had done any kind of studies that went well, if we have this kind of punishment, what will the crime rate be? If we change it up or we change it down, how will that affect the crime rate? None of that exists in the 1790s. It's maybe only in the last 50 years that you've started to get scientific studies of deterrence. Some of you may know, especially there's been some very interesting investigations about the death penalty. Does the death penalty, if using or not using the death penalty, does that have a significant effect on, say, the murder rate in a state? Now that is studied scientifically, but the defendant had no red, didn't have any kind of data like that. But still, I mean, the basic ideas are there, the basic sort of structure of the calculation existed. You have to do this kind of cost-benefit analysis of punishment to achieve the greatest happiness. Okay, so now what I'm going to do is, for the last 5 minutes or so, and then I'll stop. Now I'll go through what I think is really one of the deep and interesting philosophical claims he makes. In fact, I find it quite powerful myself. And that question is this. If you were really thinking about this, if you really did know about the pleasure, and if, for example, you knew how much pain a crime caused the victim, like that you had information about this, and you knew, for example, how much pain a punishment would cause a criminal, and as well as these other facts you need to know, how would they count? How would you count these different kinds of experiences in one big cost-benefit calculation? And here's the problem. Again, philosophers have debated this since Bentham's day. Do we count the pleasure and pain of a criminal in the same way as we count the pleasure and pain of a victim, or a bystander like a taxpayer who has to pay for prisons and so on, or tax? Bentham's great opponent, not that they knew each other, but the person who lived at the same time, was Kant. And Kant, in some ways, suggests in his retributivist philosophy of punishment that it's a good thing for criminals to suffer. That's so to speak, a benefit to society when criminals suffer in itself. And what I want to just read to you now, and this is going to be in our book, okay? If Bentham is thinking about this question, how in utilitarian philosophy does the pleasure and pain of the criminal count? So the pleasure would be, and this would be the difficult problem for him, the pleasure that, say, a criminal got out of committing a crime, right? Is that a good thing in itself, the pleasure that a criminal gets? And then the pain that we want to consider is the pain of punishing a criminal. Is that bad in itself? Or, as Kant seemed to think, is that good that criminals suffer in itself? So, if Bentham's theory of intrinsic value is true, then the pleasure and pain of criminals has the same intrinsic value as that of any other person. Right? The pain of the criminal is intrinsically bad, and her pleasure is intrinsically good. And these claims have been denied by some retributivist philosophers like Kant. And on the other hand, as I said, parallel claims have been made about a criminal's pleasure. So a philosopher might say that the pleasures that criminals derive from their crimes are intrinsically bad. Whereas Bentham says, no, the pleasures that criminals derive from their crimes are intrinsically good, just like anybody else's pleasure. It's a very challenging claim. John Rawls, I think some of you must know John Rawls' name. John Rawls once argued, in effect, that the criminal's pleasures are intrinsically indifferent, right? Meaning they're not good, they're not bad. Whereas Bentham says they're good. Rawls made a well-known objection to utilitarianism that in determining whether slavery is morally right or slavery is morally wrong, it counts the interests of slaveholders in the same way that it counts the interests of slaves. This is Rawls's criticism of utilitarianism. The correct view, Rawls says, is that there's no moral worth in satisfying the claims of slaveholders. It just doesn't count morally. It's not good, it's not bad, it's just not to be counted at all, said Rawls. And Bentham was aware of these kind of claims, although Rawls lived many years later. right? And here's what he says, because he does explicitly address these things in IPNL. In IPNL, Bentham writes as follows. It is evident that anyone who reprobates any released particle of pleasure as such, from whatever source derived, is pro tanto a partisan of the principle, he says. Beginning in the little case that he's writing stuff. I'll explain in a minute. He says it's only on this principle, which he rejects, and not from the principle of utility, that the most abominable pleasure which the vilest of malefactors ever reaped from his crime would be reprobated if it stood alone. So what is he saying there? He's saying that if somebody gets some pleasure, you pick your most awful crime, and somebody gets some pleasure out of committing that crime. And now what we need to do, he's saying, is philosophically, just think about the pleasure. Don't think about its effects on anything. Just think about the pleasure itself, in itself, as he puts it. Right? So it's just standing alone. Is that good or bad, that pleasure? And he goes, it's good in itself, but it's bad because of its effects. It might lead to, say, the torturing of somebody or to some other awful thing that would be done to the victim. And so what he's saying is that the pleasure is intrinsically good, but instrumentally bad because of the effects it leads to in terms of other people's pain. So he stands his ground and he says that if you carefully separate the pleasure that a criminal gets in itself from the effects that it has on people, you still can say what he says, which is that all pleasure is intrinsically good, including the pleasure of a criminal. Okay, what about the pain and punishment? Look, this is the last word, and then I'll stop. Bentham does consider this also in IPML. At one point he says, and this is again 18th century ways of talking, he says, all punishment is mischief. That's the word he's using rather. All punishment is mischief. It sounds like Dennis the Menace, but what he means is it's a bad thing. Right? Punishment brings about something bad for the criminal. In itself, it's evil. Even the pain that a criminal undergoes in punishment. So here's the way he's thinking about punishment. He says, if you consider something like, say, an actual physical punishment, like, say, caning somebody, the pain that a criminal feels if he's caned is intrinsically bad, just like anybody else's pain. It's intrinsically bad. But on the other hand, it may be instrumentally good because it may discourage the criminal from committing a crime in the future. And it may also serve as an example to other people. Those would be good effects that can continue to reduce crime. But the fact of the matter is that the pain itself is bad, or the pain in itself is bad. And here's a passage, this is not actually from my email, but another work he wrote at the same time. I find this a very powerful passage. He says, he says, it ought not to be forgotten, although it has been frequently forgotten, that the delinquent is a member of the community, as well as any other individual, as well as the party injured himself. That there is just as much reason for consulting his interests as that of any other. His welfare, his well-being, the criminal's, is proportionately the welfare of the community. It's part of the community's welfare, is the criminal's welfare. His suffering is the suffering of the community. It may be right that the interest of the delinquent should in part be sacrificed to the rest of the community, but it can never be right that it should be totally disregarded. In other words, what he's saying is, that if the pain of the criminal is intrinsically bad, that doesn't mean the criminal can't be punished. He's prepared to inflict pain on criminals if it will produce the most happiness. But he says that you can't disregard the pain that the criminal undergoes in calculating how much you should punish, because the criminal is a part of society just in the way that the victim is. And the criminal's punishment has to be calculated or reckoned on in exactly the same way. That, I think, is something maybe we should talk about as I conclude. And that, I think, gives you some sense of this kind of philosophical radicalism or this willingness to kind of challenge people thinking about something like punishment. So I'll stop there.
Can I ask you some questions?
Okay. Do you want to call up people? You probably know.
Yeah. We'll, okay. First question?
I'm not as familiar with Fenton Bank Mill, but the main issue I've always had with, well, there are two issues with utilitarianism, and one I think is the general fairness issue, which you kind of hinted at, which is probably theoretically the more difficult problem, but practically the problem is quantification issue. And I just wonder if you could address that, because that's the same thing that there just doesn't seem practically to be a way of measuring.
Right. Yes. So, when Bentham wrote about this, I mean, he, in theory, you're reckoning on pleasures and pains. But what he tried to do is find things that he thought were, so to speak, correlated with pleasures and pains, and would give you some kind of rough approximation. So that's why he talks about, for example, sensibility, because he thought, for example, the class differences between people would make a difference in how much they suffered from a given kind of punishment. And some of his ideas, you know, we wouldn't accept now. Like he thinks that a gentleman, right, shouldn't be subjected to some of the things that a working class person could be subjected to, because they're not as tough, so to speak, as working class people. But so, and there are other things. He thought about sex, and he thought about race, and he thought about a lot of things in terms of how they might correlate with pleasure and pain, which was for him the ultimate things to care about. So he was aware that we needed help in sort of approximating, you might say, to the right answer. I think he probably also thought that if you had a specific criminal in front of you, you would know more about that particular person and might therefore have more sense of what would be an appropriate punishment because you know more about their particular psychology. So that he had rough ideas to sort of help him think this through. So a lot's happened in the last 200 years. My understanding is that, for example, a lot of public policy and economics now, which has been very influenced by Bentham, uses other ways to try to be more precise. So, and don't ask me to go too far with this, but that economists, for example, use money in some ways to sort of measure things, they use it to measure anyway strength of preferences. So on the one hand, you know, in terms of bad things or painful things, how much would you pay to avoid it? But, and in terms of good things, how much would you pay to undergo it, to have it, or experience it? And that those can give you something like what he was looking for. And there are other ideas, sophisticated ideas, to try to quantify these things. But in a way, the point is, you know, we should be working on this because we should, if he's right, we shouldn't be inflicting more pain than we need to, and we should try to come up with things that are at least approximate measures and that have sort of more precision than we could possibly have had in 1789.
I have two questions for you. What about victimless crime? Is, you know, like prostitution or gambling, you know, yeah, when it's really hurt,
right,
you know, there's a great pleasure involved. And the other thing is, it seems to me in the 18th century, in England anyway, most crimes were punished by hanging, you know, or anything, and if not that, then mutilation or whipping or something, in any place, the punishment was right away. I mean, they weren't put in prison for long periods of time because taxes would have to pay for prisons.
Right.
So the criminal was punished or killed right away. There was no... It seems to me that society had more pleasure that way because they had less taxes to pay. So, you know, nowadays, 20th, first century, they're in prisons for long periods of time.
Right.
And even if they're sentenced to death, that takes years and years and years and years.
Right.
It seems to me that those people are punished a lot longer. So what do you think about that?
Okay, so as to the first one, that there are victimless crimes. When you actually look at IPML, and Bentham has this enormous chapter that's called the Division of Offenses, and he divides them up into various categories. And one category of crime It's what he calls, and he invented this phrase, self-regarding acts. Right? His basic idea is that he finds it hard to understand how that could really be harmful or wrong. Because his basic thinking is, if you consented to it, right? So with prostitution, or just, you know, like say you smoke marijuana or something yourself, right? That's not his example, but his point is that what people generally know what gives them pleasure. And so what he actually does in IPML is he goes, you know, self-regarding actions, I have trouble with that. I don't quite see why those should be crimes. And so he just sort of tables them and goes, I'm not even going to discuss them.
Okay.
Now, in the 19th century, his father, John Stuart Mill, wrote this famous book called On Liberty, you know, about how society should never, you know, only harm to others should remain into criminal acts. It really is sort of there in Bentham, but Bentham did write a book called On Liberty. Later in his career, he did write about these things. He wrote, for example, in the 1780s about usury. That was kind of his first application of this idea. He defended usury, which was, again, sort of outrageous. And he's going, look, you know, if you have a willing buyer and a willing lender and a willing borrower, you know, how can that be wrong? And later on, he wrote apparently quite radical things about sexuality. Again, never published in his own lifetime. In 2014, it's a little bit late here, but in 2014, his book called Of Sexual Irregularities was finally published by the Bentham Project. I haven't read it, but I've read some reviews. But apparently there, he again had real difficulty seeing why, you know, consensual acts of a sexual nature, you know, between adults should be crimes at all. So his own philosophical theory tended to be very skeptical about these things, actually. Okay, so the other question was, about how quickly punishments were imposed. Bentham thought himself that in human decision-making there are fundamentally three parameters. There's pleasure and pain, that's one, the amount that you expect to experience. There's the certainty and uncertainty of whether you're going to get it. And there's what he calls proximity, or how, in time, how quickly it will happen. And he thought that human beings, for example, tended to discount things that are far away in time. Irrationally, perhaps, but they did. And so in terms of deterrence, I think he thought that, just given that, the further away in time that punishments were from the crime, the less and less deterrence you were going to get. He got that idea from Beccaria, his great Italian predecessor, who actually said that, Beccaria said that the more certain a punishment is, the more lenient it can be. And he also emphasized that the quicker it is, the more effective it's going to be as a punishment. And so Bentham certainly accepted both of those points. Now, that doesn't decide any given issue, but it means that if you can be quick and you can be certain, you can be much less severe. On the other hand, Bentham looked at it the other way, because they didn't even have police, actually, in 1789. That was sort of the invention of the 19th century. So Bentham thought that actually you had to be more severe because it wasn't going to be certain, and therefore you had to sort of increase the severity because the certainty was less. But that you can turn it around and use it as an argument for leniency if you have a good police force.
Yeah, following up a little bit on what David was talking about, and you talked about class structure, and it seems like at his time, in Bentham's time, very minor things like stealing a loaf of bread, you could be hanged, but the upper class could get benefit of clergy, which if you could read and write just a little bit,
that's right,
you could just get away with
right
things. So later on, there was a change in view about, you know, the harshness of the punishment. Did Bentham have anything to do with that?
Yes. First of all, Bentham was basically opposed to the death penalty, as Beccaria was before him. Bentham's, as I said, Bentham had this panopticon plan for prisons, and he's considered one of the reforming figures in criminal law.
prisons themselves, I mean, you mentioned the punishments that were common in 18th century England. I mean, there was hanging, and there were corporal punishments. The other thing was transportation, as they called it, which meant until 1776, you got sent to America, and then when that closed, they sent them to Australia. And so the reformers, and Bentham was one of them, thought that prisons would be better. Again, the panopticon is often thought of as a horrific thing, but the things that Bentham was looking for is that prisoners wouldn't be preying on one another, that they'd be given work, that they'd develop work habits. And in fact, his own idea was that they would all be released. I mean, there was nothing in his scheme where your average, even bad criminal was going to be in prison for his entire life. And in fact, when he was... His whole proposal to the British government was a sort of outsourcing thing, and he was saying to the British government, look, I'll run the prison for you, you pay me. And one of the things that he offered to the British government as part of this deal was that there would be a sort of insurance scheme that if criminals committed crimes, then he would have to remit some of the money to the British government. So he was planning on giving them work habits and getting them out and back into society. And in fact, as far as I understand with these private prisons now that we have, they never have that kind of clause in it, right? A sort of performance aspect of the clause where there's some kind of guarantee that the people don't commit crimes again. And Bentham was prepared in his own prison to give that sort of guarantee to the British government, and he was going to lose money every time a criminal got out of his panopticon, committed a crime. And so it was, in some ways, bizarre, but in other ways, actually, I think, quite humane.
Yeah, I think it's better than the snake pits that are high-security prisons nowadays.
Right, I mean, there was high surveillance, there was rigorous work, but there was the notion that you were going to get out. The other thing that was bizarre about it, but also in fact quite interesting, was that it was going to be open to the public, so that people could just come and sort of go have a sort of a viewing platform where they could see the prison. And of course, you know, it sounds like they didn't have any privacy, and that was certainly a problem. But the idea was, on the other hand, they couldn't mistreat the criminals because people could just see what was going on. And so in some ways it was meant to be sort of reforming and promising people that for good behavior they would get back into society.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you. Sure.
If you want to take your own by your city,
sorry.
Allow that now.
Yeah, thank you.
If you learn under the subject of animal rights, was there a distinction made either by Bentham or by his godson about the role of human responsibility? He did write that animals have feelings.
Right.
They cannot speak or reason or write, but they suffer.
Right.
And did you, or have you learned anything about any distinction made between the level of suffering that, for example, a horse would suffer more or less than a dog who is chained and is unable to be free?
Right.
That's number one. Number two, and perhaps because it's been 200 years, I don't know how much experimentation was done scientifically. But what would your opinion be as to his ideas about terminating the life of an animal, a dog, for example, to determine whether or not we can improve the quality of life for everyone else, whether or not this death of this animal, without suffering, but suffering would be the determination of the life of that animal, whether that's justified, and whether or not that could be something that we should consider in our modern society. Those are my questions.
Yeah. Okay. Let me see. let me just sort of paraphrase it and tell me if I've got your questions right. So the first question was comparing how different animals might suffer, given different kinds of treatment. In other words, the relative amount of suffering or happiness they might get from different forms of treatment. Yeah. So what I know of Bentham, the discussions of these things are fairly fragmentary. But for example, he does say that, in that famous passage in IPML, he talks about how some animals, the very intelligent animals, he speaks of as more conversable than an infant. Meaning that, for example, we have sort of bonding and a kind of communication, say, with a grown horse in a way that we don't have with a newborn infant. And of course, it changes over time with the infant. So he had some notion that sort of intelligence could have an effect on their conscious life, their experience. There have been many people since, and Peter Singer, you probably know Peter Singer's name, Peter Singer, who's the great sort of advocate of animal rights and recognizes Bentham as a predecessor, Peter Singer has written a lot about these things in a way that I think Bentham he couldn't have written. First of all, because we have much more sort of neuroscience and ways of studying animals and also studying animal behavior and so on. But I'll just say one thing that Peter Singer said about this that's very striking to me. He says that the animals generally lack the ability to lack language. And he says that can affect their happiness with regard to their relations with us in two ways. Because he said that if I can find a human being that I speak the same language, I can say to that person, look, I'm going to let you go tomorrow. Right? But if I can find, a bird or a dog, right, I can't communicate that. Right? And so in some sense, their lack of language makes them more vulnerable than human beings. But on the other hand, there are things that dogs can't worry about in the way that we can worry about. And so their mental abilities have kind of complex relationships to the amount of suffering that our interactions with them can cause. And I think we know much more about that now than Bentham. But Singer still wants to use the basic idea that their happiness, their pleasure and pain counts the same way as ours do, but that how we interact with them has to take into account things like their intelligence. Okay, so, and now, sorry, the second question, I forgot, so help me with that one.
Okay, I'll talk about this for a minute. It basically goes to the heart of the issue of experimentation and scientific experimentation with animal remains, and whether or not that experimentation with the remains of animals benefits, good, that's received from that, justifies the determination of that animal's life.
Oh, so you're talking specifically about some scientific experiments on animals?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. Again, a big question that people like Singer think about a lot. But Singer wants to think about it in terms of a kind of impartial calculation of everyone's interests. So, as I understand his position, he's against most forms of experimentation on animals because the payoff in terms of human happiness is very small. Like for causing death and pain to animals to test cosmetics, for example. The gain isn't great enough for human beings. I think he thinks that if the only way we could prevent terrible diseases to human beings, deadly diseases to human beings, was to kill some animals, that again, that calculation might work out to be acceptable. But in fact, as I understand it, and I'm not a scientist, but that a lot of experimentation that we thought we needed to experiment on animals now, we can use simulations and we can also use tissue rather than living and conscious animals. So there are ways to minimize the use of animals even when we have that particular use in mind.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Since you brought up the comparison of Kant and Bentham's contemporaries, and then you sort of fast forward and take about put forward about almost 200 years to Don Rawls's theory of justice. I'm curious to compare one of his contemporaries, knows it on anarchistic and utopian, what you would think of a comparison of the two of them on retributive justice, you know, how do you prevent murder, how to limit it, and so forth.
Right, yeah. I mean, of course, Nozick is extremely, you know, anti-utilitarian, and the book is constructed around that, although he's also a great opponent of Rawls, too. In Anarchy, State, and Utopia, as I remember, there's like about 2 pages on punishment. And I can't quite pull up what he says there, but I'm sure it's not utilitarian. In his later book, Philosophical Explanations, there's about a 10-page or 15-page treatment of punishment, part of his theory of value. And what Nozick has got there he's trying to combine sort of the consequentialism that, you know, Bentham is part of, but with retributivism. And so what he defends is this idea that there's something sort of valuable in itself in, as he puts it, being connected to good values. And so he thinks that instead of thinking about the consequences of punishment in terms of its effect on the crime rate, we should just think about the fact that if you impose a just punishment on a criminal, that's good in itself, independently of its effects, because you're connected to sort of the right or the just moral order. Now, I think Bentham would just find that totally mystifying, because punishments are painful. And so he's going to say to somebody like Nozick, who has a theory like that, which is a sophisticated form of retributivism, how can it really be right to inflict pain on people when it has no further good effects? So you get back to this fundamental disagreement about whether there's anything good in itself in causing people's pain. And Nozick says there is. And Bentham's view is, no, there isn't. The only acceptable moral reason you could have to inflict pain is because it will produce pleasure or reduce pain later on. So it's kind of the Kant Bentham debate all over again. Yeah, and a very sophisticated, Nozick is, you know, a very sophisticated philosopher, but it's fundamentally Kantian in being non-consequentialist.
I don't know a great deal about Jerry Bentham's philosophy, but I was wondering if you could clarify 3 aspects of his principle of utility.
Right.
The first being, does he make any qualitative differences in experiences, in goods? I know John Stuart Mill does that.
Right.
So for instance, could I conceivably say that spending an hour with my daughter is as much of a good as eating 5 slices of pizza? Or whatever slice, there are many slices of pizza.
Right. Yeah.
Could you say the flip side about fads? Are there certain fads that are qualitatively worse than others?
Yeah, okay, so good. The answer basically is, for Bentham in theory, no. And in fact, one of the great differences between Mill and Bentham, and Mill was very respectful in utilitarianism in speaking about that, but that on that point they differ. And so Mill has what he called his qualitative hedonism, where there are qualitatively higher and lower pleasures. And Mill says that even if it's the same amount or quantity, however we want to think of these units, right? So, you know, like there's 10 units of pleasure, but you could get it from pizza eating or from human companionship, and it's 10 units. But Mill goes, one is better than the other. Right? And he says that the famous the passage you probably know is that it's better to be Socrates dissatisfied than if you're satisfied. And that means even if it's the same, you know, well, there it's dissatisfaction and satisfaction. But even if it was pig satisfaction and Socratic satisfaction unit for unit is better. And Bentham doesn't accept that. He thinks quantity is the only thing that affects the value of pleasures and pain. And I think that his way of dealing with this is that, in terms, again, of the instrumental value, that companionship, for example, typically has further effects that tend to be good. And so that, again, if you just isolate the pleasure itself, then whatever gives it to you, you know, it has the same value unit for unit. So his hedonism is called quantitative hedonism, and Mills is qualitative hedonism, and they differ on this point.
So the way you resolve that is if we're saying it has an effect on something else, which would have a good, so you would measure it quantitatively that way by this series of different concepts.
Right, it's total effect on the world, not just sort of what its value in itself, but what also count whatever else it has effects on the world. So for example, he thinks that pleasures, for Bentham, the highest pleasure is sympathy. Because he thinks that, you know, to share other people's pleasure and pain has effects on how you behave. And if you're pained by another person's pain, you're more likely to relieve it. And that's a good thing. So in that sense, the pleasures of sympathy, he says, are the highest because of their effects. And the lowest are what he calls the pleasures of malice, I think he calls them. But if you get pleasure from somebody else's pain, well, that's probably going to be bad for them, right?
One last question is, what about aggregating this utility across different individuals? Did you make the assumption that what's painful for one individual would be equally painful in the same circumstances for another individual? And how, on what basis does he add them up?
Well, the adding is a second question. I mean, the first one I was already asked about in a way, which is he thought that there are things about human beings that sort of correlate. So, for example, if somebody has sort of been in the Army or the Navy, they're probably sort of, you know, tougher than philosophy professors, and so that, you know, a different external experience might cause them different amounts of pain. So he had to use kind of intuitive notions of which things correlate with pleasure and pain. And, you know, over 200 years, people who are sympathetic to Bentham, you know, have tried to develop other ways to get more precise about this.
One more question.
Yeah.
It's on? Okay. Did Bentham ever consider the absence of pleasure as being an evil or a bad thing to experience?
Okay, yeah, this is complicated and tricky. Okay, so, no, it's fine. It's a fascinating thing. So, what I said was, you know, roughly you could think of causing pain as being the things that makes things wrong. Technically, that's not going to be right for Bentham, because one thing I could do to you that you wouldn't want me to do is not sort of cause you pain, but to, so to speak, diminish the amount of pleasure you're experiencing, right? So that, like, you're having a good time and then I play a squeaky violin or something like that. And so I don't give you pain, but I just, you know, sort of diminish the pleasure. And that might be wrong too, because if I stopped playing it, you'd have more pleasure and that would produce more happiness. So reductions in pleasure as well as productions of pain could make for wrong actions. Now, what you're asking about, I think, is something different, which is, what if I'm not feeling either, right? Like if I'm just in the middle, right? Well, or another way to put it, and Plato, and this was discussed even in ancient philosophy, was are all of our experiences either pleasures or pains, or is there sort of an intermediate one that's neither, right? Now, Bentham doesn't have to give an answer to that. I mean, in other words, he could say that every experience is either pleasant or painful, and there's no intermediate experience. But I think he thought there were intermediate experiences, and so those would, so to speak, have zero value. They'd be indifferent. So they wouldn't be bad, right? So if you've got to think of it mathematically, they're not negative numbers. They don't reduce the amount of good in the world, but they don't increase it either. They're sort of zeros. And I think he did think that there are experiences that are neither, and those would be, you could say, the old term is indifferent, meaning neither good nor bad. So reductions in happiness can be bad in a way, because it could have been that there could be more, but if you actually have an experience that has no pleasure or pain in it at all, then that experience has no value or disvalue, no badness and no goodness. And you know, I sort of think that we do have experiences like that that are just kind of in between. But that's sort of a psychological experience.
That's not exactly my question.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
That's actually just part of my question. the thing I appreciate about the way you presented Bentham to us is he sees pain, no matter who's experiencing it, as a bad thing. And pleasure, no matter who is experiencing it, is a good thing. And the defense of pleasure is something that we need to do. Because pleasure can be kind of subtly and not so subtly eroded. Like, you don't mind spending time away from your family. You don't mind a two-hour commute to work. You don't mind spending hours on the telephone with insurance adjusters. All of these things, while not exactly bad, are very concretely diminishing the pleasure in life in ways that are hard to talk about and to defend, is where I'm going.
Right. I mean, maybe... this is me talking more than him, but I mean, I think we can say that there are some sort of mixed experiences that have both of them going on at the same time, right? Like that they could be pleasant in some ways and painful in others, and then you would have to sort of balance them. And others of them, like say waiting on the phone, you know, for some answer from a company, might be actually bad or painful or slightly annoying. But you're hoping that you can achieve something. So it might that thing might just be just sort of pure badness, but have the instrumental value of getting you something good later on. So you can say that, you know, both of these things are possible. Well, you could have the thing I was talking about at first, which is that you could have things that just reduce the amount of pleasure. And of course, if you could have more, then having less is not as good. You could have mixed experiences that are somewhat pleasant and somewhat painful at the same time, and then you'd have to sort of reckon, you know, how to balance them out. And then you could also say about some of them that they're just sort of slightly painful and annoying, but that you sort of pay that price because you think it'll get you something that is pleasant. So there are different ways to think about these kind of everyday annoyances, and it might be that sometimes they're one and sometimes they're the other and sometimes they're a third. But the point would be, from his point of view, you always want the most happiness you can have. And even if you have some, if you could have more, it would be right to aim for that. And if you have some, but it's mixed with pain, but you could have some that wasn't mixed with pain, then that would, you know, should aim for that too. And in those various ways, you can think about sort of maximizing happiness, and which would be also reducing all the amount of pain or unhappiness that got mixed in with, you know, your experiences. So there are different ways to sort of improve it.
You have an entire society based on something like the work ethic, which makes the individual be intrinsically more painful than pleasurable, but instrumentally for the society, it's a good thing.
Right.
And if we're to defend the individual's right to pleasure in their life,
yeah.
I kind of find intransigence,
Can you say more about that? I'm not sure. I thought I was following.
Pain is pain and pleasure is pleasure, no matter who's experiencing it.
Right. Yeah, and that you shouldn't, that it should be a fair and impartial sort of understanding of, you know, which trade-offs we're prepared to make as a society, and to recognize the pains of being pains, no matter who experiences them, so that he thought was the right way to think about how to sort of improve society, because you're acknowledging all the things that are bad as really being bad.
Okay, what's that for Mrs. Sherman? Okay,